So this is a debate between Jatkarva Artabhaga and Yajnavalkya. So this is a Jatkarva is a one of the Brahmanical teachers, and one of the forms of discussion in these is like a succession of debates between Brahmanical teachers. And usually, if Yajnavalkya is taking place, he always wins the debate, and the debate is kind of a successive debate. So they start out with kind of debating relatively simple things and get progressively more abstract and profound as they go along. So this is just a short excerpt from a much longer dialogue, which we won't go into too much, and we're not interested to look, you know, analyze all of the aspects of these dialogues, which are very rich and have a lot of interesting things in them, but we're just interested to look at a few of the different details in how questions of rebirth and so on are handled. Sorry about this, my battery is going down. Ah, so the question 8 says to Yajnavalkya, Yajnavalkya, when such a person, a sage, dies, do the vital breaths, the pranas, move out of him or not? No, replied Yajnavalkya, they are gathered up in him. He swells, he is inflated, and thus inflated, the dead lies at rest. Okay, this is actually quite an important statement about the nature of death. One of the most natural interpretations of death is that the life force is your breath. Okay, because when you die, you're not breathing anymore, right? You're dying, your life. So he's asking the question, is this what death means, right? That means that your breath is gone. But he's saying, well, no, it doesn't mean that, because you can see that somebody after the death, their body puffs up, right? They get expanded. So it's obviously that they still have breath inside them, right? The prana is still gathered in them. It hasn't left them. So when such a man dies, what does not leave him? The name, for the name is a nama, is endless. The Vishvadevas are endless, and by it he gains the endless world. Yajnavalkya, when the speech of this dead person, is that big enough to see, by the way? That's right. When the speech of this dead person enters into the fire, breath into the air, the eye into the sun, the mind into the moon, the hearing into space, into the earth, the body, into the ether, the self, into the shrubs, the hairs on the body, into the trees, the hairs of the head, when the blood and the seed are deposited in the water, where is then that person? Okay? So here is kind of one of the notions, one of the kinds of notions of death and rebirth, which we find throughout the Vedic and Upanishadic literature. Not so much the Vedas, more in the Upanishads. And here, it's the idea that a person's made up of different kind of elements, your body and breath and different aspects of you are made of different elements, and they return to those elements. We find this notion also in the suttas, but as always in a much more sort of common sense way in the suttas. It says like your earth element returns to earth element, water returns to water, and so on. So all of these parts which you make you up all go back to their sort of native habitat, if you like. So where is that person? So what's left over, right? All of these different bits are gone. So what's left over? What's the essence? Remember before I said Yajnavalkya's, one of his key teachings, neti, neti, not this, right? So here's all these things which are not you, right? So the teaching on not self, right? The Buddha wasn't the first one to teach not self, yeah? He was the first one to teach that, to take it to completion, right? Yajnavalkya's teaching, all of these things are not self, but at the end of the day, there is a self. Right? So the Buddha sort of took this method and then extended it to its completion. You look like you were going to ask something, no? Yeah. Okay. Sure?
Sure.
Okay. So what's left over? So then, it's very interesting. Yajnavalkya then said, take my hand, my friend. We two alone will know of this. Let this question of ours not be discussed in public. So remember that they were having a public debate, right? So other people were hearing it, and all of those things they've heard so far were suitable for the public arena, but this one is not. Right? This one, only in private. Then those two went out and argued, and what they discussed was karma, work, and what they praised was karma. Whereby a man becomes good by good work and bad by bad karma. After that, Jatakarva Artabhaga held his peace. Okay? So a very interesting passage, right? So notice that when so many people say the notion of karma is like universal in India, right? Everybody believed in karma. It was taken for granted. Everyone believed in the teaching of karma and so on. Well, obviously it wasn't, right? It was obviously a extremely unusual secret teaching that only the very highest level of philosophers could discuss between themselves, and they couldn't do so in connection with other people. Why not? Oh, sorry, I should.
Is that a theory, Bhante? Is that a theory, or are you just saying that from this text?
From this text and from the culture as a whole, yeah. That's consistent with how it is in the how it's treated throughout the Buddhist texts. Not everyone believes in karma, and throughout the Upanishads as well. Yeah. So the idea was, it was there, it was gradually finding currency, and over time it became more and more common, but obviously here it's quite a secret teaching. Why is it a secret teaching, right? Why would you have to go to one side and discuss this? Yeah. Why? Because you have just destroyed your entire culture, okay? You have just said you go to heaven by doing good, not by doing rituals, yeah? So if you take that doctrine of karma seriously, the entire Vedic tradition is now completely thrown out the window. Huh? And of course, that was an issue which they've wrestled with ever since that time. And of course, in the Buddhist text, that's exactly what the Buddha did. He didn't have the problem, how do I reconcile this with the teachings of the Vedas? He said, throw the Vedas out, don't worry about them. Huh? That notion of karma is ridiculous. But what you do, what your acts are, that will have an effect. Right? So this is how he redefined karma. Any questions on this passage before we move on?
Is it doing with intention?
Here, not yet. Right? So it's about your deeds. So this was another step which the Buddha taught, was to talk about what's your intention. But you can see that it's not entirely different from like the Upanishads, is why I mentioned this idea before, ya evang veda, one who understands this, right? So while you're performing the act, in that context it meant performing the ritual, right? Mm-hmm. But while performing the ritual, what was your understanding of that, right? What was your intention? So it's starting to look to what is that inner thing, right? So the precedents are there, but it's not yet putting it all together. Yeah. Yes?
The person who conveyed that knowledge,
Yajna Valkya.
Is he the first, and who is he?
Sorry?
Is he the first that you know of to talk about karma? And if so, who is he? Is he a sage?
He's a great sage who lived about 100, maybe 200 years before the Buddha, and who had a lot of discussions with King Janaka of Mithila, which was in one of the regions which was part of one of the cities that the Buddha used to travel to. In Patanjali discusses Yajnavalkya and his grammar a few hundred years later, and he talks about the different sages who composed the Vedic books and things like that. And he regards them as being essentially timeless sages of the ancient past, right? But then he comes to Yajnavalkya and talks about him and says, but of course, Yajnavalkya lived not so long ago, right? So they had this memory that actually these are fairly recent events. And the king who he mostly discusses with is Janaka, we find in the next dialogue. And actually Janaka is mentioned frequently in the Jatakas also as a great king of the same city, Mithila. He was clearly a historical king who lived in Mithila, the kingdom of Videha, 100 or 200 years before the Buddha. And to this day in that region they have the town of Janakpur, which is, we guess, his capital. So here we're sort of moving into that realm where the text is starting to relate to the history.
Is this the first instance of mention of that?
Well, there's some things in... What mention of what specifically?
That suggestion that there's something that lives on in karma.
This is... Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
I'm interested to know whether you think that is a... kind of perhaps was being discussed in secret amongst all the thinkers of the time, or whether this was just
discarded. I think Yajnavalkya was an innovator. Mm. Yeah. And it's quite possibly the ideas that he came up with himself. Yeah.
Wasn't he like a meditative disorder process,
It's hard to say. The Upanishads don't have a sort of clear description of the meditative process like you find in the Buddhist texts. However, they frequently have a feeling that sounds like they've come from some kind of meditative or contemplative experience. Right? You know, like say the passage I mentioned before, which Yajnavalkya says many times, you know, the unheard hearer, the unthought, the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the unknown knower, right? To actually phrase and think in those terms, you know, it sounds like that kind of understanding, that's what meditation experience is like, isn't it, right? It gets you in touch with that subjective sense of knowing, which is aside from all of that normal worldly phenomena. So this is just one of many, but there are many passages that are suggestive of a contemplative life, which I think was, you know, very much a part of this Brahmanical Upanishadic period. But you don't find clear descriptions of meditation until the post-Buddhist period.
Yeah. Oh, Mandy, they're talking about rebirth here as well. So when they talk about developing good karma, are they talking about changing the karma in this lifetime or the next lifetime?
Probably not clear yet. Yeah. Probably not clear. There is the idea that you can become liberated in this life. Yeah. Let's have a look at a couple of other passages. But remember that these are ideas which are just emerging and finding their first expression. So they're not necessarily all mature. Anyway, let's have a look. It's another interesting discussion here. Again, part of a much longer debate. Between Yajnavalkya and Janaka, the king of the Videhas. And Janaka was this fascinating king who, you know, always loved these philosophical debates with Yajnavalkya. In fact, this particular one was very a nice setting because Yajnavalkya had taken a vow of silence, and so he didn't want to debate with the king. But he also had made a promise to the king that he would always answer his questions. So he has this dilemma about how so the king manages to wheedle his way into getting Yajnavalkya to answer. Anyway, so Yajnavalkya begins with this image. Now, like a heavy laden carriage moves along groaning, thus does this corporeal self, mounted by the intelligent self, move along groaning when a man is thus going to expire. If you're familiar with Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Buddha describes his body just before he dies as being like an old cart which is kept together by straps. And the body grows weak through old age or becomes weak through illness. At that time, a person, after separating himself from his members, as an amra, as a mango or a fig or a pipala fruit is separated from the stalk, it hastens back again as he came to the place from which he started to new life. Okay, so it's like a fruit falling off. The fruit's grown up from the ground, become a tree, and then come to the fruit and then falls off and falls to the ground again to become new life. So this idea of a life as a cycle. As policemen, I don't know if policemen is entirely correct, but anyway, policemen, magistrates, equerries, I don't know, what's an equerry? I don't know. Horsemen. Anyway, governors, wait for a king who is coming back with food and drink, saying he comes back, he approaches. Thus do all the elements wait on him who knows this. Again, one who knows this, Yajurveda, saying that Brahman comes, that Brahman approaches. Right? So when someone's dying, someone with wisdom, a sage, then the elements are all waiting for him. And just as policemen, magistrates, equerries, and governors gather round a king who is departing, thus do all the senses, the prana, gather round the self at the time of death when a man is thus going to expire. Now, when the self, having sunk into weakness, sinks as it were into unconsciousness, then gather those senses, the pranas, around him. So the word prana in the Upanishads means something like a vital energy, but it also means something like a sense faculty. And he, taking with him those elements of light, descends into the heart. When the person in the eye turns away, then he ceases to know any forms. So this is talking about the process of death and one of the earliest sort of descriptions of that process of death, which is found in any literature. So you're becoming weak, senses starting to close down and start to go inside. He has become one. Eki bhavati, they say. He does not see. He has become one. He does not smell. He has become one. He does not taste. He has become one. He does not speak. He has become one. He does not hear. He has become one. He does not think. He has become one. He does not touch. He has become one. He does not know. right? Again, this emphasis in the Upanishad tradition was always about the one, right? It's about the unity, everything coming together as one. The word eki bhavati here is exactly the same as the word that's used in the Buddhist scriptures to talk about samadhi, eki ekagata or ekodi hoti, eki bhavati. So he becomes one, withdrawing from all the senses, all the different activity, only becoming one. The point of his heart becomes lighted up, and by that light, the self departs, either through the eye or the skull or through other places in the body. When he thus departs, life departs after him, and when life thus departs, all the other vital spirits depart after it. He is conscious, and being conscious, he follows and departs. So even though he's leaving his body, he's still conscious. Then both his knowledge, his jnana, and his work, his karma, take hold of him and his acquaintance with former things. As a caterpillar, after having reached the end of a blade of grass and having made another approach to another blade, draws itself together with it, so too does this self, after having thrown off this body and dispelled all ignorance, and after approaching another body, he draws himself towards it. Just like a goldsmith taking a piece of gold turns it into another, newer and more beautiful shape, so does this self, having thrown off this body and dispelled all ignorance, make himself into another, newer and more beautiful shape, whether like the fathers or the Gandharvas or the Devas or like Prajapati or Brahman or like other beings. That self is indeed Brahman, consisting of knowledge, mind, life, sight, hearing, earth, water, wind, ether or space, light and no light, desire and no desire, anger and no anger, right or wrong, and all things. Now, as a man is like this or like that, according to as he acts and according as he behaves, so will he become. A man of good acts will become good, a man of bad acts, bad. He becomes pure by pure deeds and bad by bad deeds. And here they say that a person consists of desires, and as is his desire, so his will, as his will, so his deed, and whatever deed he does, that he will reap. So, of course, in this whole passage, we're coming very close to the Buddhist, both the Buddhist descriptions of the whole rebirth process, right? And of course, the rebirth process is not really talked about much in the Theravadan tradition because they have this idea of the instantaneous rebirth that was never a main concern. But in the Tibetan tradition, we have very elaborate descriptions of that. I think also in the Chinese tradition and so on. And those traditions are, well, not identical, but very much similar to those descriptions. And of course, we can also recognize similarity with what we hear today is near-death experiences, the kind of withdrawal of the senses, the experience of light, and so on and so forth. Yeah.
So is he orientating karma more to being like the alchemy of death as opposed to the ritual dimension?
Right, exactly. No mention of the ritual there. Yeah? Very good point, right? They've completely gone beyond this whole idea, which was essential in the Vedas, right? Yeah.
So I'm just still curious why it was kept as secret men's business.
For that exact reason, because you've just blown up your entire culture. Yeah, I mean, this is what Socrates got executed for, right? He questioned the gods, and they took him off, and they said, you know, you've been corrupting the youth by telling them to question the gods. What punishment should we give you? And he said, you should erect a home for me in the city square so that I can continue to educate the youth. So they said, right, off with his head. So this is really, it's difficult for us to recognize how challenging this is, right? I mean, the Indian traditions, you know, they became very, you know, they were very open-minded. There was a lot of tolerance and a lot of questioning and so on. But to get to that state, then there has to be work, right? You have to cross those marks, yeah.
The ritual is still very important,
it
still remains important.
Of course, yeah.
So the good deeds here, not only actions of body, speech, mind, but could they not also refer to the appropriate
conduct of rituals? On the first one, you could be, but of course you're mentioning the idea of good and bad, right? So this is bringing in the ethical dimension. Right, and then the next paragraph, this is almost entirely Buddhist, isn't it, right? as is desire, so is will, so is will. So here is the first time you're bringing in the idea of intention, right? And so the intention behind the act is not just the act itself, but it's the intention behind it and the desire, motivation. That's a large part of Buddhist psychology is being anticipated right in that sentence. Yeah? Whatever deed he does, that he will reap.
That isn't necessarily a ritual.
It's got nothing. It does preclude ritual. No role for ritual in there. It's defining and discussing karma entirely without reference to ritual.
I agree that ritual is a reference.
Yeah. They don't go so far as to say you don't need rituals. Yeah, that's true, and that's something which, you know, the Buddha and the other Shramanas then said. But you can see that there's not far away from it.
In later Hindu philosophy, they talk about the Dharma, and your Dharma is the role that you must play.
Right.
And so for certain people, carrying out those rituals is the role that you must play. They're your good deeds. And they maintain the universal order. So
right.
If you participate in those, then you're also helping to maintain the universal order, so
therefore
it's good.
Yes, yeah, that's right. So there's the sort of resolving of those. Yeah, so the ritual and the karma, you try to bring them together. But of course, there's always a tension between them, isn't there? Partly there's a tension because some rituals are intrinsically unwholesome, especially animal sacrifice and human sacrifice. So that's a problem. But then, you know, always the question says, well, if you're doing your rituals is good and that gets you to heaven, but what if you don't do them? And of course, this is the question that the Buddha asked to the Brahmins. You know, you think rituals are so important, but if someone lives a good life, and they're always kind and generous and compassionate and honest and so on, but they don't do the rituals, right? Are they still going to go to heaven? And of course the Brahmins were forced to admit, well, yes, they would. That's a little bit later, yeah. So then there is this verse, to whatever object a man's... So notice here, just a sort of literary feature of it, that the text is quoting an earlier text, right? So they're bringing in another thing which they are inserting in there. To whatever object a man's own mind is attached, to that he goes strenuously together with his deed. And having obtained the end of whatever karma he does here on earth, he returns again from that world to this world of action, to the world of karma. So this is something which Gombrich talks about in his interview, that there's this kind of quite simple dualistic cosmology. You find echoes of it in the Buddhist texts, but it's almost like there's this world which is the world of karma, right? This is the world that we do stuff, and then the other world is the world where we experience the results of that stuff. So we act here, we experience the results there, and when those deeds are exhausted, then we come back here. Again, this idea we find... It's not an absolute in Buddhism, but always the tendency in the Buddhist texts is to treat the human realm as being the realm where we make the most powerful karma. It's not that you can't make karma in other realms, but that usually in the human realm where we make the most powerful karma and we experience the results and then we come back here. So just if those of you had a bit of familiarity with Pali, you see some of these phrases are actually very... very characteristic. Well, you know, you could say that these were Buddhist quotes from the suttas and you wouldn't find them at all unusual. Yatha gari, yatha jari, tatha bhavati. As you do, as you live, so you become. Sadhu kari, sadhu bhavati. One who does good becomes good. Papa kari, papa bhavati. One who becomes bad becomes... One who does bad becomes bad. Punya, punyena karma, papa, papena. By good karma, one becomes good. By bad karma, one becomes bad. Okay. This is Sanskrit. It's an evolved form of the Vedic Sanskrit that lies sort of between the language of the Vedas and the kind of classical Sanskrit. That's much closer to classical Sanskrit. In fact, it's almost the same as classical Sanskrit. Yeah, remembering that Panini, who formulated classical Sanskrit, lived in the century after the Buddha. So he was living maybe 200 or 300 years after this text was written. Yeah. The Vedic texts are quite different. Yeah. I mean, if you know Sanskrit, I mean, if you know Sanskrit, reading this would be like reading Shakespeare, right? And reading the Vedas would be like reading Chaucer. Yeah. So yeah, you can kind of recognize it's the same language, or maybe even like reading Beowulf. No, probably like reading Chaucer. Anyway. Okay. So much the man who desires, but as to the man who does not desire, who not desiring, freed from desires, is satisfied in desires and desires the self only. Yeah? So again, this idea, this neti, neti idea, you're not attached to anything in the world, but only one thing left. Ah, the self, the Atman. His vital spirits do not depart elsewhere. Being Brahman, he goes to Brahman. So this is the enlightened person, the sage. So this is, again, this idea that there's two paths, the enlightened one, Jivan Mukta, is he being Brahman, he goes to Brahman. When all desires which once entered his heart are undone, then does the mortal become immortal, then he obtains Brahman. Just as the slough of a snake lies on an anthill, dead and cast away, thus lies this body. But that disembodied immortal spirit is Brahman only, is only light. And so finally, we come to another discussion. This one is not as philosophically interesting as those previous ones, but gives us an idea of some of the perhaps more animistic conceptions of rebirth, but also includes that idea of the two pathways. So this is Sweta Kedru Aruneya with Pravahana Jaivali, king of the Panchalas, Panchala being another kingdom which is known in the time of the Buddha, Sweta Kedru being another well-known sage in the Briharanika. So it's from the same text. They take him, just talking about what happens when someone dies, they take him to the fire, the funeral pile, and then the altar fire is indeed fire, the fuel, fuel, the smoke, smoke, the light, light, the coals, coals, sparks, sparks. In that very altar fire, the devas offer man, and from that oblation, man arises, brilliant in colour. Yeah? Interesting conception of the funeral, isn't it? Yeah? The funeral is where the god are offering a man as a sacrifice. Yeah? And from that body, the man arises, brilliant in colour, i.e. the flame that arises, the energy that comes out, is your true essence. Thus, those who thus know this, okay? Again, ya evam veda, and those who in the forest worship faith and the true Brahman. So these two kinds of people here, the householders, grihasthas, and those who in the forest worship faith in the true Brahman. Okay, so this is the ascetics in the forest. There's no asceticism in the Vedas. Right? This is a new idea, probably introduced from the Shramana religions. But in any case, so here you have those two, but both of them who understand this, they go to light, from light to day, from day. So this is talking about the course of the soul after death, right? From light to day, from day to the increasing half. That's like the bright half of the moon, right? When the moon is becoming brighter. From the increasing half to the 6 months when the sun goes to the north, i.e. the summertime. From those 6 months to the world of the devas, from the world of the devas to the sun, from the sun to the place of lightning. When they have thus reached the place of lightning, a spirit comes near them and leads them to the worlds of the conditioned Brahman. In these worlds of Brahman, they dwell exalted for ages. There is no returning for them. But they who conquer the worlds by means of sacrifice, charity, and austerity go to smoke. So this is talking about those who are not those who know thus, right? Those who don't understand, the people who do the sacrifices and so on, but without understanding. They go to smoke from night to the decreasing half of the moon, from the decreasing half of the moon to the 6 months when the sun goes to the south, from these months to the world of the fathers, from the world of the fathers to the moon. Having reached the moon, they become food. And then the devas feed on them there, as sacrifices feed on soma, as it increases and decreases. The soma is the drug that they used to have at the sacrifice to give them altered states of consciousness, and it was always identified with the moon growing and shrinking. When the result of their good works on earth ceases, they return again to that ether, right? So there was, they've done their good karma, their good rituals, and they get reborn on the moon, and then they participate in the sacrifice there with the devas. Then they return again to space, from space to air, from air to rain, from rain to the earth. When they reach the earth, they become food. They are offered again in the altar of fire, which is man, and thence are born in the fire of woman. Okay? So the path of birth passes through the man to the woman. Thus, they rise up again to all the worlds and go the same round as before. Right? So there's this kind of cycle, which is it's a very physical thing, isn't it? Yeah, it's this kind of strange mix of these, you know, philosophical and animist ideas, and going through up to the cosmos, the moon, and so on, and down and round again. So this is the path of somebody who's does the rituals without understanding. So those, however, who know neither of those two things, right? So you don't even do the rituals without understanding, they become worms, birds, and creeping things. Notice no notion of hell, or kind of lower realms. The animal realm is the only lower realm that's conceived. So again, you can see how these notions, you know, in there is the notion of rebirth and so on, but it's very different from the notion, the understandings that we know today. So that when the Buddha came along, he obviously didn't just sort of uncritically adopt any of these teachings, but he would always inquire and use discrimination and discernment. Okay, any questions on that? Before we think we've still got time for a discussion group. So, any questions? Barbara?
Who said this?
This one was Swetaketu.
Is that a significant
Sorry?
Is that a significant
He's one of the sages from the, who's mentioned quite a few times in the Brihadaranyaka. Yes, so he is one of the major sages of that time. Yeah. And having a chat with the king here, so obviously a personage of importance. Yeah.
Is it really significant to the passage earlier that said the eyes go to the sun and the hair go to the trees and stuff? Is that based on anything physics-wise, or is it just saying that the body goes back to the earth?
Yeah, well, first of all, you can see it's quite a different thing to this cosmology, right? It's not like there's a unified system. This is what, you know, happens after you die, right? Everybody had these all these wild theories, but that idea is based on the idea I mentioned before of sandhi, of connection, right? So it's the idea that, you know, your eyes have a certain essence, right? That essence is connection with light and with vision, and so there's sort of an intrinsic, the intrinsic nature of your eyes is connected with the sun, which is the source of light. So when you die, it's like that this is, again, that idea that there's a whole, things are wholes, right? So there's like that light is a whole, and your eyes have kind of temporarily split off from that whole. Actually, they always belong with the sun, but you're kind of borrowing them for a while. And then when you die, they go back to what their real home is. So all those different, it's like, you know, we've collected all these parts and they all go back to their real home. And so then the question is, who's the self? What's left over? Who's been doing the borrowing of all those bits? Yeah. So it's quite, in many ways, it's a very beautiful philosophy, right? Because it's all about that sense of being interconnected. You know, you can see that it's like finding a whole, finding a sense of meaning, because actually, you know, I'm part of all of these things that's all around. Yeah. Sorry. Rowini.
Person
who
talked about the neti.
Yep, Yajivalkya.
Okay. Do you think that he got that concept through meditation? And also, do you think that his meditation wasn't deep enough to see the concept of Anatma?
Well, the second question, obviously, it wasn't, right? Because he never really saw that completely. Did it arise through meditation? It's hard to say. I mean, it seems to me likely, You know, I mean, to me, that's the kind of thing which happens when you meditate, isn't it? You let go of all of these different things, and all those things that seem meaningful to you, they vanish. And the more that they vanish, the more you feel like you're coming back to your true home, you know? So to me, that all makes perfect sense in terms of a meditation experience. But like I said, there just aren't clear descriptions of meditation, so it's a bit hard to say exactly.
It's a pretty deep concept.
Like, very much so, yeah. Yeah. And this is, you know, this is something that, you know, comes to the fore, especially with Yajnavalkya. You never got in Western philosophy at all, right? This insight, you know, the thing that really matters is who is it that knows? Yayevam Veda. Who's the one that knows all this? And the Western philosophy always concerned itself with the externals, the known, but not with the knowing. Right? And still does today. You know, and I think this is still the big stumbling block in the Western understanding of consciousness and so on. There's still, if you read people talking about what's the nature of the mind, the nature of consciousness and so on, they're all concerned with all the externals, all the nama rupa. And no one's actually seriously looking at the vijnana, at the consciousness, because your mind slips off it. And this is that kind of, that insight again, that from Yajnavalkya, the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the unknown knower. And how do you define it, right? It's just that it's the most important thing, but there's nothing to it.
Yes.
Yeah? And so this is what he comes back to, that sense, that knowing, and say, oh, this must be myself. This is who I really am. And this is why it's such a profound insight for the Buddha to then come along and say, even that is not self, right? I mean, how can you say that, right? How can you have that sense, that those samadhi experiences and so on, of such purified, incredible knowing, and say, even that is not self?
Yeah. Ante, but then Buddha describes what he actually means by knowing the anatta discourse. He says, if it was myself, I could make it this world. And the consciousness level is just there. You got no control.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. And that wishing things maybe, I mean, it comes back to the kind of magical thinking that you can sort of have a wish and then it'll be like that. Yeah. Justin?
Yeah, one of the comments.
Yeah.
This passage is quite interesting because I find the parallels quite similar to the Aztec religion.
Aztec?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Where they did offer
yeah.
Depending on whether you sacrifice ritual and stuff, you'll be led to these various realms. And like the passage where it says following like the sun.
Yep.
This is what happens when like you're a warrior and like that, and then you go to these.
Right.
You haven't had this ritual sacrifice since you're going to different realms, like different levels of soul, etc. And it actually parallels quite
similar.
It's quite interesting because they're completely different from what they're doing. So.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, yeah, like, where would this sort of knowledge be derived from?
Well, you know, I mean, your guess is as good as mine. I mean, you know, you've heard the kind of the history and so on. You know, I think partly these things are kind of natural, fairly kind of natural inferences. So, for example, when you burn a corpse, you know, you see the corpse turn into flame, and the flame goes upwards, right? But the flame also is made of light. And the flame is kind of like the sun, or perhaps kind of like the moon, right? So it's going up as well, whereas it goes, oh, it must be going back home. Yeah, so, you know, there is a sense in which there's a kind of common sense to it. I think that partly explains the parallels. Whether it fully explains them, I'm not sure. Well, I think one of the things also is that we, because we have an attachment to a sense of self, a sense of identity, so we want to look for something that will allow us to believe that our self will continue after we die. Yeah? And so normally we sort of look to a religious philosophy or something like that to give us that reassurance that something will happen after we die. But if you look in the natural world, the most obvious thing is the celestial bodies, right? The sun, the moon, and the star, because they don't die, right? Everything down here is rotten and changes and dies and weathers and gets old. And the stars, well, just look at them, right? They just stay there. And the sun just beams down every day, right? So if you're looking for an idea of eternity and changelessness, then it's natural you'd look to the heavens. Yeah. Okay, so let's we got half an hour left, so I think we're supposed to have the lunch break at 12:30, is that right? I think 12:30 was the lunch break, is that right? Yeah. So we have half an hour. We can either have a discussion group or we can have a meditation session. Which would you like to do? Meditation. Okay, that's good. Let's do that. It's supposed to be put away there, so unless you kept it out, is it on the back there?
Would you mind listening?
I don't think this would happen. These doors open, you know.
Do you know how to use it? I think it's on.
It's on. We're just trying to lower the temperature.
Lower the temperature of that, or lower the temperature of the room.
Is that 20 now?
It's not 20 degrees in here. Take it down to 18.
Is that 18?
Yeah. Sub-zero temperature.
Okay. So welcome back, everybody. Did you all have a good lunch?
Yes.
Okay, very good. That's one of the advantages of doing day-long workshops at the Buddhist Library. You can go and have lunch in Newtown at a nice cafe. Sorry?
Or you can have Deepika's curry.
Or you can have Deepika's curry, it's one of the other advantages, yeah. Okay, so for this session, we're going to look at what the Buddha said. And we've looked at on, you know, all the different the context and so on. And we'll look at how the Buddha engaged with and had discussions with people in his time and his place. And one of the things which is very remarkable about the early Buddhist texts is the extent to which they are involved with interfaith, okay? And this is something which radically marks off the early Buddhist texts from every other form of Buddhist literature, okay? So all Buddhist literature from the time of about 100 or 200 years after the Buddha until today has essentially been Buddhists talking to other Buddhists, right? And you never, virtually never, find any case of a Buddhist actually in a dialogue with somebody who's a non-Buddhist. Right? Whereas in the suttas, you find that all the time. Yeah? Almost every second sutta is the Buddha talking to some Shramana or some Brahmin or something like that. In the Digha Nikaya, it's a majority of suttas are like that. In other Nikayas, maybe less so, but still a lot of interfaith dialogue. And that interfaith dialogue happens in a number of different kinds of ways. Sometimes it's somebody coming to ask the Buddha for advice. Sometimes people have a lot of faith in the Buddha. Sometimes people come to criticize or attack him. Sometimes people are very genuine. Sometimes they're just trying to have a go at him and trying to put him down. Sometimes there's a sort of a genuine engagement, and other times, you know, it's very hostile, and all different kinds of things. And throughout all of it, you can see that the Buddha's response, you know, he always keeps this very characteristic sense of equanimity, this characteristic reflectiveness, and sort of sense of engagement with people. He doesn't give up on people easily, even when they're attacking him or criticizing him or something like that. But we also see the Buddha is very generous in the way that he had dialogues with people. In a number of cases where the Buddha would go to visit another ashram or another community of non-Buddhist ascetics, one I'm thinking of particular, where they then asked him, please come and teach us, tell us what is your teaching. And the Buddha said, well, leave that be, you know, let me hear what your teaching is. And all of those wanderers say to themselves, that's so amazing, right? Every other time that a visiting teacher has come here, they can't wait to tell us all about their ideas, right? But here comes the Buddha, and even when we ask him, he says, please let me hear about your ideas first. So the Buddha was very, very kind of generous in the way that he related to him, but he wasn't a fool, right? He wasn't going to be taken for a ride, and he wasn't going to be just satisfied with easy platitudes, right? It was a genuine sense of engagement and wanting to find out the truth, right? So we see this wide variety of different kinds of responses. And we'll see a few of those today. Now, one of the main ones we'll have a look at here, and this is one of the important teachings on karma, is the Devadaha Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 101. And this one in a translation by Venerable Tanisaro, if I'm correct. It's Venerable Tanisaro. So these are dialogues with the Jains. Now, I mentioned these briefly in the session this morning, but I'll just say a little bit more about them before we proceed. If you remember, I noted that there are these kind of two streams of religious or philosophical peoples in the time of the Buddha or in ancient India, the Brahmins and the Shramanas. The Brahmins coming from the Vedic tradition, the Indo-European tradition, which we looked at through the Vedas and so on. And we didn't talk so much about the Shramana tradition. So the Shramana tradition, of which the Jains are the most prominent example, aside from the Buddha himself, sprung up, it seems, locally and natively in that region where the Buddha lived. They're usually sort of located around Magadha, one of the main cities in ancient India. And the prevailing hypothesis among historians is that the Shramana movement is largely a kind of indigenous movement, probably evolved from what might have in a tribal society might have been more like sort of the witch doctors, right? The shamanic kind of priests doing trances and things like that. And so they evolved these kind of things like these ascetic practices and so on for developing some kind of altered states of consciousness. Now they were in relation with the Brahmins, right? So there was some kind of relation to them, but they certainly didn't come from the Brahmins. They seem to have sort of evolved together and influenced each other to some degree. Now, according to the Buddhist texts, there were various of these Shramana movements existed before the time of the Buddha. And in fact, it's frequently said that, you know, these other teachers are very old and very senior and have very, you know, very long standing, whereas the Buddha is young in his prime of youth with his hair is still black and he's only recently gone forth. So the Buddha was considered to be the younger contemporary of the leaders of these other movements. So the Jains were around before the Buddha. One of the reasons I didn't discuss them too much before is because we don't have such good textual records for the Jains as we do for either the Buddhist or the Brahmanical tradition. There are Jaina sutras and texts, but those texts were compiled at a much later date, about 1,000 years later. And the Jains themselves admit that their early texts were all lost. Okay? So the Jaina texts do contain early portions. There are some parts of them which can be considered to genuinely come from the early period, but on the whole, they're compiled at much later date. So this is one problem, that the Jain texts are later. The other problem is that they're, well, pretty obscure, really, difficult to find examples of them on the web. They have been, or at least important ones, have been translated, and you might find copies here in the Buddhist library, but I won't look at them too much. But what we'll look at is some records by the Buddha of his conversations with the Jains. It's always a bit dubious to rely on, you know, the kind of outsiders, specifically if you want to understand the Jains, you should understand it from their perspective, right? Not from the Buddhist perspective, because obviously the Buddhists are going to say that the Jains are wrong. And funnily enough, if you read the Jaina Sutras, they'll always say that the Buddhists are wrong. Go figure, right? Nevertheless, you know, on the whole, the way that the Jains are depicted in the Buddhist texts agrees fairly well with how they're depicted in their own sutras as well. Okay, so this is one of the discourses with the Buddha relating a dialogue with the Jains. Before I go on to the sutta, any questions on that?
Is there any sutras where the Buddha says he was wrong, where the householder converts, or the assembly is delighted for what the Buddha says is right? Is there any evidence in any of the sutras where he changed his mind? Where the Buddha admitted he was wrong. I'm looking for bias. I'm not looking for him being wrong, I'm looking for bias in those people who may have actually written the decision.
I can't think of any examples off the top of my head.
Maybe not the sutras, but Vinaya's assembly, Vinaya's evolving.
The Vinaya is evolving, yeah, all the time. And so, I mean, the Buddha doesn't necessarily say he's wrong, but he will certainly lay down a Vinaya rule and then something happens and then he'll revise it, right? And that happens very frequently. Yeah, so I don't know if that's a similar kind of case. Yeah. Anyway, okay, let's go on. On one occasion, the Blessed One was staying among the Sakyans. The Sakyans have a city called Devadaha, and there the Buddha addressed the monks. Monks, there are some Brahmins and contemplatives, that's Shramanas and Brahmins, who teach in this way, have this view. Whatever a person experiences, whether pleasure, pain, or neither pain, pleasure nor pain, all is caused by what was done in the past. Okay? So that all is caused by your past karma. Right? Thus, with the destruction of old actions, right, your old karma, through asceticism, through performing acts of tormenting your body, with the non-doing of new actions, there will be no consequence in the future. With no consequence in the future, there is the ending of karma. With the ending of karma, the ending of suffering. With the ending of suffering, the ending of feeling. With the ending of feeling, all suffering will be ended. Such is the teaching of the Nigantas. Okay. So, going to the Nigantas who teach this, and of course, as we mentioned in the myth-busting workshop last month, as you remember, this is a very common view in Buddhism, right? View that everything that we've done was caused by our karma in past lives. And we can all find very easily examples of Buddhist monks and lay people who are teaching this in the present day. So this is here, the Buddha is identifying this teaching with the teaching of the Jains. Everything is done, caused by what is done in the past. So going to the Nigantas who teach in this way, I asked them. So Nigantas is the Buddhist word for the Jains, okay? So in the Buddhist text, Niganta means, Ganta is a knot. So Niganta means literally knotless, i.e. those without attachments who have untied their attachments. The word Jain is derived from the leader, from the word Jina meaning conqueror. Jaina means followers of the conquerors. Anyway. Going to the Nigantas who teach this way, I asked them, is it true, friend Nigantas, that you teach in this way, that you have this view? having been asked this by me, the Nigantas admitted it. Yes. Okay? Again, first lesson in interfaith dialogue right there. Okay? So you don't just accept on hearsay what it is that you believe about somebody else's beliefs, right? You first thing you do is you go and ask them, is this true? Right? And in this case, yes, he got it right, and it was true. And so this is, again, characteristic of the Buddha's method, that you begin with, you start out with some common ground, you start out something, well, we agree that you agree on this statement, what next? So I say to them, but friends, do you know that you existed in the past and that you did not exist? Okay? So here, when it's talking about existing in the past, it obviously means existing in past lives. Right? It's a normal idiom in Buddhism when it refers to the past and the future. Very often it's referring to past lives and future lives. I mean, obviously they knew that they existed 5 minutes ago, right? But this is not asking a metaphysical question like that. It's asking, did you have a past life, right? So you experienced this in this life, but have you actually seen these past lives that caused this? No. Do you know that you did bad karma in the past and that you did not do them? No, friend. Did you know that you did such and such bad actions in the past? Right? No, friend. Of course, this is, again, exactly the same problem that we find in Buddhism, that something will happen to you and somebody will say it's your karma, right? What do you mean it's your karma, right? How do you know what's your karma? You know, did you see that in the past life? Did you see that person's past lives? No. Did you see them doing this action? No. Did you see this action? So what are you saying when you're saying this is past life? Actually, it's just a completely empty statement. It doesn't mean anything. So did you know that that such and such amount of suffering has been ended, or such and such amount of suffering remains to be ended, or that with the ending of such and such amount of suffering, all suffering will be ended? Huh? No, friend. But do you know what is the abandoning of unskillful mental qualities and the attainment of skillful mental qualities in the here and now? No, friend. No. So, the Buddha goes on, it seems you don't know that you existed in the past and all of these things. That being the case, it is not proper for you to assert that whatever a person experiences, all that is caused by what is done in the past. If, however, you knew that you existed in the past, if you knew that you did bad actions in the past, that such and such kind of bad actions, or that you don't know that such and such suffering had ended, or so and such suffering remains to be ended, or that with the ending of such and such amount of suffering, all suffering would be ended. If you knew what is the abandoning of unskillful mental qualities and the attainment of skillful mental qualities in the here and now, then that being the case, it would be proper for you to assert that whatever a person experiences, all that is caused by what is done in the past. Friend Nigantas, it's as if a man were shot with an arrow thickly smeared with poison. As a result of being shot with the arrow, he would feel fierce, sharp, racking pains. His friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives, would provide him with a surgeon. The surgeon would cut around the opening of the wound with a knife. As a result of the surgeon's cutting around the opening of the wound with a knife, the man would feel fierce, sharp, racking pains. The surgeon would probe for the arrow with a probe. As a result of the surgeon's probing for the arrow with a probe, the man would feel fierce, sharp, racking pains. The surgeon would then pull out the arrow. He would then feel pain again. The surgeon would then apply a burning medicine, and then he would feel pain again. At the later time, when the wound had healed and was covered with skin, he would be well and happy, free, master of himself, able to go wherever he liked. The thought would occur to him, before I was shot with an arrow, thickly smeared with poison. Then I felt sharp, fierce, racking pains. My friends and companions performed that surgery, all of the time during which I felt fierce, sharp, racking pains. But now that the wound is healed and covered with skin, I am well and happy, master of myself, able to go wherever I like. In the same way, friend Nigantas, if you knew that you existed and that you did not exist and so on, then it would be proper for you to speak in that way. But since you don't know those things, it is not proper for you to speak in that way. Okay, so here is pointing out that in that simile, the cause of all of those things is very obvious, right? You're hit by an arrow and you can see what the cause is. You can see where the pain is coming from. But in that case of talking about past lives and things, then you can't see anything. You don't know what you're talking about. So it's just something which you make up. so it's not proper to make that kind of assertion. Now, note just a few, just a kind of a almost incidental detail, but notice that particular simile is a kind of, well, it's not a very nice one, is it? Right? I mean, in Buddhism, you get lots of similes that are like, you know, the lotus growing up in the water and, you know, the sun, the full moon coming out from the clouds and illuminating the world, and all of these are kind of very gentle and beautiful similes. Also, the Buddha was not above doing some fairly graphic and challenging similes like this one, but this is actually very characteristic of talking with the Jains, and their own literature tends to be very much like this. So the Jaina literature is a lot rougher than the Buddhist literature. It's full of things like they're talking about the self-torment and torturing your body, but also, you know, they lived a very kind of rough life, right? So if you're a Jain, you know, when you ordain, you have your hair is pulled out, right, with iron pincers, right? Ooh. Yeah, nasty. And then you have to go around, you don't wear any clothes, like nothing. But they have two sects. One of them, they have like one robe, and the other, they have nothing at all, right? They call sky clad, right? So you wander around with your hair pulled out like that, and then you're not allowed to bathe, like ever. And if you're on a boat crossing a river, and the boat tips over, and you fall into the river by accident, you're not allowed to intentionally dawdle on your way out of the river so that you can sneakily have a little bath on the way out, okay? So you can imagine with these kind of naked guys wandering, you know, around stinking to high heaven with, you know, that they obviously didn't get a particularly nice reception at many places, and so there's a lot in the Jain text about, you know, you go into the village and people throw sticks and stones at you and chase you out and stuff. So it was a pretty tough life, yeah? And so this is what they were doing, you know, they were really living that thing that they wanted to actually, you know, burn off all of that past karma by doing all of these things. And, you know, they still practice like this today. There's not a large monastic community in Jainism, as you can well understand, but they still do have. And they still, you know, maintain these things. Of course, being India, they always, people find ways, skillful ways of doing these things. So, for example, like a lot of Jains these days, because they couldn't plough the fields, right? Because it's bad karma to plough the fields and you cut the worms and things like that. So they usually went into occupations where they didn't have to do that, which often meant trade, which means that over the years they actually became very rich. So in modern-day India, the Jain lay community is actually very wealthy, and a lot of these big industrialists in India are actually Jains. So they still like to do this burning off karma thing, but sometimes it's more convenient to have somebody else do it for you. So what they do is they have like particular classes of people who will drag around flea-infested mattresses, okay? And they come outside the house of the Jain people, and then the Jains will pay them to lie down in the mattress so that they can be eaten by the fleas and then burn off the... Yeah, so anyway, this is... this is what some people like to do. Anyway, sorry. Yeah, go.
I went to a big Jain gathering in Croydon, so many years
ago. Big Jain gathering. Yeah. Were they all naked? No.
They were all fully clothed, and as you say, very wealthy. And yeah. I went there to investigate the religion. I took my younger son at the time. And what they were doing was giving money, giving huge amounts of money. It was almost a competition.
Okay.
Because they'd go up and when they donate, and they'd say how much they were giving, and then the next one would come and give more.
To who?
To the organisation.
Okay.
I don't know where it ended up going. But that seemed to be how they were, you know, burning off the bad karma. And I was just to give a vast amount.
Right. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you see a lot of the Jain temples in India are very beautiful. Yeah, you know, beautiful white marble and intricate carving and stuff, yeah.
But not only that, the Jains are kind of famous for being interested in hospitals, medicine.
Absolutely, yeah.
Especially veterinary care.
Yep, yeah. And, you know, they've kept that practice of ahimsa, you know, very, very strongly, yeah. So very strong with vegetarianism and not harming any animals and so on. So, yeah, they're very, you know, they still keep that, all that stuff alive, yeah.
The Nigantha sect is one of two sects that they have.
Nigantara in the Pali canon is just a general term for all the Jains.
Also,
Tirthankara is the name for the Jain teacher. Okay, so like the Buddha in Jainism is called a Tirthankara, it means a ford maker.
Because
they have the Swetambara and the Digambara. Swetambara is the white clad, and Digambara is the sky clad.
Yeah.
So these are the two sects. But they kind of, it seems that they split shortly afterwards, after the time of the Buddha. They were still unified in one sect in the time of the Buddha. Yeah.
Because in Tibetan Buddhism, we often have this term, in our sutras, we have this term, Tirthankara.
Okay.
Which is like when they met someone they considered a heretic.
Okay, yeah, right, exactly, yes. Yeah. Yeah, there's actually two words in Pali. One is Tirthankara, which is like a ford maker, literally.
Yeah.
And so that's for like a founder of a religious sect. So that would be the Nigantara Nataputta or Mahavira. But there's also another word, Titya, which is like a follower of another sect. So it's maybe like a Sanskritized form of related to one of those words.
I'm pretty sure it's
Titya. Yeah, okay, may well be, yeah, yeah. It's just a different idiom, I guess, yeah. Okay, so, but you know, one of the things is, apart from this teaching on karma and its effects, which is obviously a major teaching, but apart from that, you know, there's very many things which are very, very similar in Jainism and Buddhism, and they have a very strong emphasis on, you know, similar things like emphasis on analysis and inquiry, which you find in Buddhism. So very many things which are very similar. Okay, so, now, when that was said, the Nigantara said to me, "Friend, the Nigantara Nataputta is all-knowing, all-seeing, and claims total knowledge and vision. Thus, whether I am walking or standing, sleeping or awake, knowledge and vision are continuously and continually established in me." He's told us, Nigantara, there are bad actions that you've done in the past. Exhaust them with these painful austerities. When in the present you're restrained in body, in speech and mind, that is the non-doing of bad action for the future. Thus, with the destruction of old actions through asceticism and with the non-doing of new actions, there will be no consequences in the future. With no consequence in the future, there is the ending of action, with the ending of action, the ending of suffering, with the ending of suffering, the ending of feeling, with the ending of feeling, all suffering will be ended. We approve of that teaching. We prefer it and are gratified by it. Okay, so here is their response to the Buddha's critique. So this is here, they're outlining their epistemology. Okay, and so their epistemology, as they're presenting here, is essentially that they rely on the authority of their teacher. Okay, so they believe that their teacher is omniscient, and Nigantara Nataputta made a strong claim to omniscience. Okay, another point of difference between the Nigantas and the early Buddhists. Okay, so the Buddha rejected this kind of strong omniscience, and he said it's not possible to continuously and know everything. Of course, later schools of Buddhism, all of the schools of Buddhism, attributed this kind of omniscience to the Buddha, but he himself rejected it. It's a bit unclear in the Pali texts whether the Buddha claimed a weaker form of omniscience, which would be something like he would know whatever he wanted to know whenever he wanted to know it. Okay? That's a bit unclear, but what is clear is that for the most part he claimed to know the Four Noble Truths and dependent origination and so on. So his main claim to knowledge was those spiritual truths rather than general claims to being omniscient.
Knower of the world.
Loka vidu, yeah. Yes, loka vidu, that sounds like it's claiming to be omniscient, but of course then he redefined loka to mean the six senses and the six sense objects. Yeah? So the world is this world of senses. So yeah, I mean, it's not dissimilar to the idea you find in the Mahayana, where you have this, you know, on the one hand is this omniscience, but then of course it's all mind created anyway, right? So it's all actually is you're knowing your own mind, because the whole world is your own mind. Yeah. So these, yeah.